Yes, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying, have a good.
Today is Tuesday, October the 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Sudan's military seized power in an apparent coup on Monday, with the top general declaring a nationwide state of emergency and announcing the end of a joint civilian-military council that ran the country for the past 2 years. The U.S. will suspend $700 million in bilateral assistance to Sudan in response to the military's takeover.
The civilian-led transitional government should be immediately restored because it represents the will of the Sudanese people.
The Biden administration is offering details on new COVID-19 vaccination requirements for most foreign travelers flying to the U.S.
and to provide proof of vaccination status prior to boarding an airplane to the United States.
And a team from the University of Western Australia has crossbred frogs that are tolerant to climate change. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, millions of people in the United States are gearing up to get COVID-19 booster shots amid ongoing controversy over vaccine mandates. Michelle Quinn reports.
With 77% of Americans having received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, people are talking about what they should do next. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has approved booster shots to some extent for all three approved vaccines, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer. For the booster, the CDC says people can pick a different shot than the one they received, essentially mixing and matching vaccines. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the White House's chief medical advisor. He spoke on ABC this week.
That allows a considerable degree of flexibility for people to get what we hope they will get, namely a booster that will increase and optimize their protection.
This week, health officials will meet to discuss Pfizer's report that its vaccine is safe and effective for children ages 5 to 11, setting up the possibility that inoculations for them may start in early November. News of boosters and the possible vaccination of children comes as a little more than 22% of adults in the U.S. have yet to receive a single dose. Employers continue to roll out vaccination mandates. American Airlines says its employees must submit proof of vaccination by the end of November or face being fired. New York is offering city employees who haven't been vaccinated $500 for their first dose, but promising consequences for those who refuse. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
If not, as we saw with healthcare, with education, you get a letter that says on November 1st, you're going to go on leave without pay. We don't want that for anyone. We just want to get people vaccinated.
The New York City Police Union said the decision to be vaccinated was a personal medical decision, and it would seek legal action to protect members' rights. Vaccine mandates remain controversial, with 58% of Americans saying in a recent Hill-Harris X poll that the directives are helping the battle against COVID-19. 24% say mandates are hurting. That divide is similar when it comes to whether the mandates are helping the economy, with 51% saying the policies help, and 35% say they hurt. How the U.S. handles the pandemic in coming months will likely have a political fallout. In addition to the pandemic, Americans are worried about the economy, inflation, and supply chain issues. In recent weeks, President Joe Biden's approval rating has slipped, averaging 43%. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
And the Biden administration is offering details on new COVID-19 vaccination requirements for most foreign travelers flying to the U.S. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
Starting November 8th, they'll have to be fully vaccinated.
And to provide proof of vaccination status prior to boarding an airplane to the United States.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says there will be very limited exceptions.
primarily children under the age of 18 and certain individuals from countries where vaccines are not yet readily accessible.
All travelers will need to be tested before boarding a plane to the U.S. The administration says it's working with airlines who will have to enforce the procedures and collect contact tracing information. The CDC will spot check passengers for compliance. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
President Joe Biden spent hours Sunday at his home in Delaware with two pivotal senators as they seek to resolve the disputes over Democrats' wide-ranging social safety net and environmental bill. The White House calls Biden's time with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin a productive meeting, but no deal has yet been announced. Biden is pressing for progress he can spotlight to world leaders at overseas summits that get underway this week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she expects an agreement on a framework by week's end. And for more on how the talks will shape the infrastructure bill, my colleague Chinedu Ofor spoke with VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell.
It sounded like that was a productive breakfast. That is what the White House said, that it was a productive breakfast, that a lot got done, and that they're close to a deal. What we do know is that Senator Joe Manchin's big point of departure with the rest of his party was over a $150 billion clean electricity program. And that is because his state of West Virginia is pretty prevalent in the coal market. There are about 14,000 coal workers in West Virginia out of a population of about 1.8 million. But even so, that's a concern for Joe Manchin. He wanted to be seen to be voting his constituency, as we say. That's kind of what the holdup was.
Do you know of any outcome of that meeting or a timeline as to when something concrete will actually happen?
Anybody who's guessing at timelines, even Nancy Pelosi, has been wrong a few times this month. So I wouldn't hazard a guess about when. But what we are hearing from the White House is they do hope that this can happen this week.
Some progressive members of the Democratic Party are enraged at what they see is some kind of an obstruction by Senator Manchin. How is that shaping up? Is this a problem within the Democratic Party?
So there was a little bit of fuss last week when Joe Manchin said, fine, if I'm not going to get on with the rest of my party, I will leave my party and be an independent. Allegedly, that's what he said. And there were members of his party that welcomed that and said, fine, leave the party, become an independent. But that seems to have blown over. Whatever was actually said by Manchin and by everybody else seems to have blown over, and he is staying with the Democrats. I think we have to recognize that the two parties that we have in this country are kind of broad churches. We have people of all sort of persuasions and opinions, even within these parties. They're not as tightly disciplined as we see in countries with parliamentary systems. This is part of the, as White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki would say, this is part of the legislative sausage making. This is part of the process to have a little bit of disagreement because, you know, we have 50 very different states that all have representatives who are ostensibly fighting for their states first and foremost. And so this is bound to happen.
The president appears to be throwing in a lot of political capital into this reconciliation bill. How politically dangerous is that if the president fails to deliver?
This is the signature item that Joe Biden wants to achieve in his first year in office. So if he doesn't deliver on this in any form, if he doesn't even deliver the, we're now hearing it might be $1.75 trillion for the reconciliation bill, if he doesn't deliver anything, that will obviously be a blow. That's not how the White House is going to paint it. They're going to say, well, this is legislative sausage making. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and point to other pieces of legislation that were just as contentious and that failed for other reasons. This could weaken, I suppose, the Democratic Party, but it just really remains to be seen.
That was VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Powell. She was speaking with International Edition's Chinedu Ofor.
Voice of America!
A top Sudanese general, Abdel Fattah al-Burhani, said in a televised address Monday that he has declared a nationwide state of emergency and dissolved the joint civilian-military government. Al-Burhani said the move was necessary due to quarrels among political parties ahead of a planned transition to civilian rule. Protests broke out in Khartoum earlier after Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok was arrested by military units and taken along with his wife to an unknown location. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Crowds of protesters marched on the streets of the Sudanese capital Khartoum Monday to express their opposition to the military takeover of the country and the dissolution of the joint civilian-military government earlier in the day. Amateur video showed protesters burning tires and blocking main roads. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who led the sovereign council that ruled the country for the past 2 years, said in a televised speech that he had dissolved the government due to political quarrels that were threatening the security of the country, and insisted that a new government of technocrats will soon be appointed. He says that divisions among various components of the government were threatening the security of the country. He insists that constitutional texts will be respected and that a new government composed of independent technocrats will be appointed. Adam Harika, a spokesman for deposed Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, told Arab media that the army took Dr. Hamdok to an undisclosed location and that his supporters are holding those who ousted him responsible for his security and safety. We call for his immediate release, he added, and we believe the Sudanese people will oppose what he called this coup. Miriam Sadiq al-Mahdi, leader of Sudan's Hezbollah Ummah party and foreign minister in the outgoing government of Dr. Hamdok, told Arab media that her party opposes any coup by any party and for any justification, and that we will fight it by all peaceful civilian means, defending the constitutional document that Sudan's young people have paid for with their blood. Hussam Zaki, deputy secretary general of the Arab League, told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the League calls on both parties to observe the constitutional document put in place after the 2019 ouster of veteran former leader Omar al-Bashir, as the Arab League was a party to the document. He said the current situation raises worries, and the League is calling on all parties to respect the document until the end of the interim period and not to royal security in the country. As the day went on, internet service inside Sudan was reportedly cut, and communications with the country became extremely difficult, with phone lines cut in the middle of interviews by Arab media with Sudanese political leaders. The U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, who was in Khartoum over the weekend, said in a statement that he was deeply alarmed by reports of the apparent coup in Sudan. He added that any changes to Sudan's transitional government by forces puts U.S. assistance to the country at risk. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Biden administration will suspend $700 million in bilateral assistance to Sudan in response to the military coup. Speaking to reporters in Washington, State Department spokesperson Ned Price also called for the military to release civilian leaders and a restoration to civilian rule. Ned Price also called on the military to refrain from using violence against protesters.
The civilian-led transitional government should be immediately restored because it represents the will of the Sudanese people. You don't have to take our word for that. You can look at the outpouring of support that the transitional government has received, including in recent days. The peaceful protests across the country where hundreds of thousands, if not more, turned out to show their support for their transitional government. So we are very much standing with the people of Sudan. The people of Sudan have made clear their aspirations for the continuation of a transition to democracy, and we will continue to support that, including, if needed, by holding accountable those responsible for these anti-democratic actions.
That was State Department spokesperson Ned Price. A U.S.-based Sudan analyst says Monday's military takeover was triggered by a fear that the military was losing control over Sudan's sovereign council as the deadline for transfer to civilian rule was approaching. Cameron Hudson, a fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, tells my colleague Nabil Biagio that internal pressure from last week's street protests that demanded a transfer to civilian rule, as well as international pressure, forced General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to dissolve Sudan's civilian-led government. He says the military takeover seems hasty and poorly planned and has taken Sudan on a dangerous path that may result in street violence and a possible counter-coup.
The military was increasingly fearful that they were going to see their their power and their position reduced as a result of the democratic transition. And they were obviously fearful of their future, and so they have stepped in and taken back control as a way of defending their own interests. Now, what's interesting is that they are saying that they are doing it to defend the interests of the revolution. So they are portraying themselves as more kind of patriotic than the politicians in the country, and that they are going to deliver, results faster than the politicians. They're going to deliver new elections faster. They're going to create a legislative council, a Supreme Constitutional Court. They're going to implement the elements of the transition that had not yet been implemented.
What do we know about the players here, the actors behind this military takeover?
We don't know fully yet. Clearly the military head of state, General Burhan, is leading this, and it has his full support. He's the one who's, gone on television and delivered these messages. It would appear, although it's unconfirmed, that he is doing this with the support of General Hemeti and the RSF. I'm seeing initial reports that suggest that the RSF is deploying its forces in the city in support of the military. But what we don't know, and what we should be fearful of, is that there are divisions within the military, especially in the younger ranks, in the lower ranks of the military, who, you'll remember, back in 2019, sided with the street protesters. So I do think that there are divisions in the military, and we should not be surprised if we see a counter coup of some kind, younger military officers who push back against what's happened.
Recent events in Sudan and tensions, everything seemed like a slow-moving coup was in motion. Now it seems to have kicked into full speed overnight. What was driving all of this?
Again, we don't know exactly what is in the minds of the military leaders. I do happen to think that there were two elements. This is my own analysis. One, the political movement, the Forces for Freedom and Change, set a new deadline for the Sovereignty Council to be transferred to civilian rule by November 17th, so less than 1 month away. And that was a new deadline and a very hard deadline. And that was, I think, the thing that the military was most fearful of, was losing control of the Sovereignty Council, the executive authority in the country. And so that deadline coming on November 17th was a very near-term worry of theirs. And I think the other thing that concerned them was that, the international pressure that was being placed on them. We know that the pressure, both from the street in Khartoum and internationally, was making them feel in a weakened position, making them feel cornered. There were reports last week when the protest marches, with over a million people were happening in the country, that General Burhan was feeling under siege, was the word that was used to me. And so I think that this is a reaction internally to relieve the pressure that they were feeling to take over.
What is going to decide what happens next in Sudan? And how do you see that playing out in terms of events in Sudan itself and the international community's reaction?
It's hard to know at this stage. It is a very dangerous situation because you have, the military trying to assert its control, and now you have people taking to the street in protests. Will those protests turn violent? will the military turn violent against those protesters? I think those are the two questions right now, which will set this transition on a different path that we should be fearful of. If this turns violent, then it is very hard to imagine talks, a reversal. It's hard to imagine regaining any kind of momentum for democratic rule in the country. And so that's the thing that we have to be, to be watching for. What I would say is this feels very hurried. It does not feel well thought out. It does not feel well planned at this point. So it does make me think that the military is reacting out of fear at this point.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio earlier today. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And for the first time in a laboratory, Australian scientists have produced tadpoles more tolerant to climate change. A team from the University of Western Australia has crossbred frogs from wetter regions with other species from drier areas to make them more resilient. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
Researchers in Australia want to give nature a helping hand. They've warned that climate change poses an enormous threat to many of the world's frogs. Genetic traits that allow a type of amphibian called a crawling frog to survive in regions with lower rainfall, researchers say, could be passed on through breeding. They've mixed frogs from drier parts of southwestern Australia with others from wetter areas. Sperm and eggs from four different crawling frog populations that occur in areas with various levels of rainfall were used in the experiment. The effort produced tadpoles that were better adapted to climate change and had increased tolerance to dry conditions. The world's first laboratory trial has been reported in the journal Communications Biology. Jodie Rowley is a lead scientist at the Australian Museum's Citizen Science Project and an expert in amphibians. She believes that frogs need help to meet the challenges of global warming.
It does seem a little bit like we're acting God in some ways, but I think at this point it's some of the only ways that we're going to be able to have these amazing frogs in the future. The times of just leaving things alone to be protected in these areas is not going to work anymore. You know, climate change is moving faster than the frogs are able to adapt themselves. So we're going to have to do things like potentially move animals from one place to the other, or in this case, give them a little genetic advantage to allow them to be able to persist in this new world that they're going to be living in.
The University of Western Australia team said that more trials would be needed before these crossbreeding techniques could be applied in the wild to reduce the risk of species extinctions. Rainfall in southwestern Australia has declined in the past 40 years, and it's a trend that's expected to continue. The project to boost the climate resilience of crawling frogs was part of research by the Australian government's conservation initiative, Threatened Species Recovery Hub. It's examined ways to help at-risk species adapt to climate change. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
And in other news, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel warned the U.S. Embassy in Havana against fomenting protests by dissidents on the communist-run island ahead of fresh rallies slated for November the 15th. Cuba has said the planned demonstrations, scheduled for the same day the Caribbean island will reopen its borders to tourism, are illegal and blames the United States for underwriting them should the government jail protesters. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com and check out our other shows, including Africa 54, Upfront Show, Straight Talk Africa, Our Voices, and many others. And remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Africa on YouTube, on Twitter, and on Facebook. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Scientists led by NASA and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics say that they may have spotted an extragalactic planet. While nearly 5,000 planets from outside of the solar system, but within our Milky Way galaxy has been detected, this may be the first planet found in another galaxy. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists led by NASA and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics say they may have spotted an extragalactic planet. Over the last 30 years, astronomers have discovered and confirmed the detection of nearly 5,000 extrasolar planets, which scientists say are found outside of our solar system but are mostly located within 3,000 light years away in our own Milky Way galaxy. This discovery could be the first planet to be found to exist in another galaxy. The astronomers making the discovery say that the candidate planet is located about 28 million light years away in the spiral galaxy Messier 51, which is also known as the Whirlpool Galaxy. Using NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, the scientists spotted what they believe is a planet by looking for transiting planets in dips of light at X-ray wavelengths. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The World Meteorological Organization warns the battle to stem climate change may be lost as new information indicates that the Amazon rainforest is turning from a carbon sink, or an area that absorbs CO2, into a source of carbon dioxide. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest edition of the WMO's Greenhouse Gas Bulletin reports emissions of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide once again broke all records last year. It warns the concentrations of these greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere are driving climate change. It says carbon dioxide, the single most important greenhouse gas, accounts for approximately 66% of the warming effect on the climate. The Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Pieter Talas, says about half of CO2 emissions remains in the atmosphere for centuries. He says the other half is taken up by oceans and land ecosystems. He says it is not clear for how much longer forested areas, often referred to as the lungs of the earth, will continue to act as effective carbon sinks.
We have already seen some alarming indications that, for example, the Amazonian rainforest ecosystem, which used to be a major sink of carbon, has become now a source of carbon, which is alarming. And this is related to deforestation in the area and also changes in local climate because of this deforestation.
Oksana Tarasova heads the WMO's Atmospheric and Environmental Research Division. She says the WMO only now is revealing this new finding because it has taken 9 years of observation to gather the measurement data set needed to understand the changes taking place. She says not all the Amazon forest is turning from a carbon sink to a net producer of carbon.
So the western part of the Amazonia still continues to work as a carbon sink at this point. But we don't know for how long that will continue this way. We are making the measurements there and keeping track on what is happening there. If we take the whole Amazonia as the whole basin, then it is a sink, but its capacity is substantially reduced.
Meteorologists say climate change negotiators at an upcoming conference in Scotland must take concrete action and make concrete pledges to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. They say setting carbon-neutral targets will not work in stemming climate change. They also warn the world is heading toward a temperature rise of 2.5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. This, they say, is far more than the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. We are at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Have a great week ahead.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.